Surely the Jewish people is no less deserving than other peoples. Are the Arabs responsible for that problem? Have they acted or worked or helped in creating such a problem? The Jewish people were your allies in the war and joined their sacrifices to yours to achieve a common victory.
The admission of the applicant, if taken, would be the highest consummation of injustice.
Argentina? Abstention? France? Yes?
The resolution was adopted by 33 votes, 13 against, 10 abstentions.
Hello, shalom, and salam aleikum. Welcome to Beyond the Headlines, Israel-Palestine. Roses are red, violets are bluish, my name is Ezra Bernstein, and yes, I'm Jewish. I'm also a recent graduate of UCLA Medical School, now in Israel doing a residency in peacemaking, a former Fulbright scholar in Israel, and a big supporter of reconciliation. This podcast is the home for a deep understanding of the conflict, and it will delve into some of the many issues that surround the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. I will include pertinent and relevant history, as well as probing questions for my guests. Guests will include both Israeli and Palestinian academics, politicians, and prominent public figures. For a few episodes, I will get real crazy and have two guests on at once to allow for a little back and forth. I think it is of the utmost importance to try and step into the shoes of the opposing narrative and or be open to hearing them out. And, of course, just because you don't want something to be true doesn't mean that it isn't. Future episodes are going to focus on the most relevant issues, but we'll also cover Jerusalem, the BDS movement, and many other topics depending on popular demand and on current events. I also want to quickly introduce a future co-host and former college tennis teammate, the one and only Alec Siegel.
Wow, one and only.
Who is here getting a master's in diplomacy and security.
Yes, hello everyone, this is Alec. You will not be hearing too much from me for the next couple of months, but after that I will be joining Ezra in the booth talking about Israel-Palestine.
Can't wait. Yeah. So I think that maybe we could just talk a little bit more about the podcast. So I think today we kind of live in a time of headlines.
For sure.
People don't go so much into the detail. Maybe you could talk a little bit more real briefly, just real quickly.
Sure.
On why we want to get this podcast started and what our goal is.
Yeah. So, you know, we're two recent college graduates. We see the things that rile young people up on college campuses, and Israel and Palestine and the conflict has become one of those things.
Oh, I'd say it riles people up.
They get real passionate about it, no matter what side they're on. And often it's people shouting over one another. It's no conversation. It's facts are thrown out the window. So we'd like to get those things back on the table. And, you know, it's becoming part and parcel of being a progressive these days is you got to be anti-Israel.
Yeah.
So we'd like to get some more nuance out there.
I think that's very well said. Couldn't agree more. Could not agree more. I think we just want to take an issue that's really seen in 1D and show it in the 25D that it really
25D.
Is.
25D.
It's like that the situation now in Gaza, it's not that quiet because the Israeli side, they keep bombing different places. Most of the places, it's empty area. And the main attack, especially near to the border, because now there is a lot of Israeli tanks around the Gaza border trying to start the land operation because they get the green light from Netanyahu to start this operation in Gaza.
I think since Thursday, we've had four alarms in Tel Aviv, four sirens, and fortunately nothing has hit the ground. It's either, I guess, intercepted by the anti-missile system or fell in open areas. As far as I know, nobody has been hurt.
I'm going to begin by talking about the history of the region and of Hamas. Then I will briefly touch on the current events before I interview a professor from Tel Aviv University to hear the Israeli perspective. And I will finish by speaking with a Palestinian-American physician with family in Gaza to hear about the Palestinian perspective. During the Ottoman Empire, the time before the British Mandate, what is now Gaza was part of a district, the Sanjak, that spanned from Rafah, which is now in the southern border with Egypt, up to Jaffa, which is near Tel Aviv. It's interesting to note that Mandatory Palestine under the British was the first time that those exact borders, which include what is currently Israel and the Palestinian territories, had been delineated as a country. This fact isn't of importance now, but I will return to it in a later episode. After the Ottoman Empire fell, Gaza became part of the British Mandate for Palestine. Now, after the War of 1948, the first Arab-Israeli War, Gaza came under Egyptian rule, and the population greatly expanded with all the refugees from that war. After the war in 1967, it came under Israeli control. That's the second Arab-Israeli War that occurred in 1967. In 2005, Israel packed up everything and unilaterally pulled out of Gaza to the internationally recognized pre-67 borders, thus ending the occupation of Gaza. Some dispute this and say Gaza is still occupied or Gaza is besieged, and that following the withdrawal, Israel has continued to maintain direct external control over Gaza and indirect control over life within Gaza. Israel still controls Gaza's air and maritime space, as well as six of Gaza's seven land crossings, and has a no-go buffer zone within the territory, and they control the population registry in Gaza. And Gaza remains dependent on Israel for water, most of its electricity, telecommunications, and other utilities. After Israel pulled out, an agreement on movement and access between Israel and the Palestinian Authority was concluded in November 2005, and this was to improve freedom of movement and economic activity for the residents of the Gaza Strip. This all changed in 2006 when Hamas won a democratic election and eventually took control of Gaza by 2007. After Hamas was elected, Israel immediately announced that it was freezing the transfer of customs revenue to the Palestinian Authority. Additionally, the quartet, which included the United Nations, the United States, the European Union, and Russia, which were all entities involved in mediating Israeli-Palestinian peace, said, quote, "It is the view of the quartet that all members of a future Palestinian government must be committed to nonviolence, recognition of Israel, and acceptance of previous agreements and obligations, including the roadmap and all previous agreements," end quote. Clearly, as an organization committed to violent resistance, not recognizing Israel, and reclaiming all of the land that was formerly part of British-mandated Palestine, Hamas does not fit what the quartet was describing. After this, Israel greatly tightened its restrictions on goods, including humanitarian goods, potentially as a way to make life for Gazans worse in order for them to turn against Hamas. I will get to this point later on.
I was home before. There was a siren about 2 hours ago. I was home. All the neighbors gathered in the, those of our home, gathered in the air raid shelter and waited until we were allowed to leave. People seem to be calm, to be accepting of the situation. It's very unfortunate that people are accepting of the situation, but that's probably the way it is. People get used to anything.
And in east of Gaza City, so from time to time we keep hearing the sound of bombing in different places, and especially in the night, early in the morning. It's the total number of the people who killed in the last few hours. It's like 24 person, 6 of them children, and 250 injured, 70 of them women.
So who is Hamas? Hamas is an Islamist and Palestinian nationalist organization and is currently the governing authority of the Gaza Strip. It is considered a terrorist group by the US, Canada, and the EU. They are the religious and Islamist alternative to Fatah. Its origins can be traced back to when the Muslim Brotherhood got split into three based on borders into the West Bank, Israel, and Gaza. In Gaza, which was occupied by Egypt from 1948 to 1967, the Muslim Brotherhood was forced to go underground because of President Nasser of Egypt. After 1967, the Muslim Brotherhood in Gaza changed a lot, largely due to a strategic error on Israel's part. Israel saw that Fatah was growing in popularity, so they let them come above ground as an opposition to Fatah. In the 1970s, the Muslim Brotherhood created teachers, school programs, and became a significant social force. At this point, the thought was that before armed struggle, they needed to take care of internal problems with social work. Thus, from a military perspective, things were quiet throughout the 1970s. As time went by, more people in Gaza started to look at the Muslim Brotherhood and wonder why more was not being done against Israel. This changed in 1979. During the 1979 Iranian Revolution, a group of people in the Muslim Brotherhood started to look at Khomeini's writings and what happened in Iran. They decided that they should change strategy and be an armed struggle first. This group became the Palestinian Islamic Jihad. They were a Palestinian Sunni Islamist organization, but followed the Iranian Shia supreme leader. Their mission was first to confront Israel militarily. In the 1980s, the Muslim Brotherhood began to feel pressured by groups like the Palestinian Islamic Jihad. When the first Intifada started, the Muslim Brotherhood was hesitant to join as they wanted to stay out of armed struggle until the social work was done. However, they didn't want to lose face as if they were not supporting the struggle, so they started a military wing to participate in the resistance while still remaining committed to social work. Sheikh Ahmed Ismail Hassan Yassin, the future co-founder of Hamas, was in charge of the paramilitary training. Thus, Hamas was born as a branch of the Muslim Brotherhood in Gaza. The Hamas charter was drawn up and has many notable aspects that are commonly cited, including calling for the destruction of Israel and killing of Jews. Quote, Israel will exist and will continue to exist until Islam will obliterate it, just as it obliterated others before it. The martyr, Imam Hassan al-Banna of blessed memory, end quote. Hamas is committed to a violent resistance as evidenced by their activities and their charter. Quote, there is no solution for the Palestinian question except through jihad. Initiatives, proposals, and international conferences are all a waste of time and vain endeavors, end quote. It has elements in its charter that refer to what their end goal is and why. Quote, it strives to raise the banner of Allah over every inch of Palestine, end quote. And, quote, the Islamic resistance movement believes that the land of Palestine is an Islamic waqf, consecrated for future Muslim generations until Judgment Day. It or any part of it should not be squandered. It or any part of it should not be given up. Neither a single Arab country nor all Arab countries, neither any king or president nor all the kings and presidents, neither any organization nor all of them, be they Palestinian or Arab, possess the right to do that. This being so, who would claim to have the right to represent Muslim generations till Judgment Day? End quote. Essentially, Hamas says that because of the holiness of Jerusalem, the whole land in Islamic trust or waqf and can't be owned by Palestinians and bargained over. This also explains their stance on the Palestinian Authority negotiating over Israel and Palestine. There are other elements of grossly anti-Semitic content in the charter, which is publicly available. They started growing during the 1990s as they got more foreign support and funding. They started being known and operating on behalf of the Palestinian cause. From a geopolitical perspective, during the Gulf War from 1989 to 1990, Yasser Arafat made a mistake by siding with Saddam Hussein. One of the main contributors to Fatah was Saudi Arabia. And after this, Saudi Arabia started to also send money to Hamas, possibly as a punishment to Arafat for taking sides. The other thing Hamas does is they start to work in the West Bank and start to restructure. As they grow, they create the Al-Qassam Brigade as their military branch, and they create a political bureau. Thus, the military branch creates a political branch. This happens because Hamas is now thinking of itself as not only a military organization, but also a political organization. In 1993, Hamas takes over the Muslim Brotherhood in Gaza, making it part of Hamas. In the first years of Hamas, the strategy and operations were mostly stabbings and Molotov cocktails. They did not have a lot of military skills. This changed following the decision in 1992 by Yitzhak Rabin to take a group of 400 Hamas leaders, arrest them, and deport them to southern Lebanon, which Israel was currently occupying, in an attempt to separate them from the center of organization. However, this was likely a mistake, as there was a great international outcry, and within 10 months, everyone was sent home. However, importantly, during those 10 months, the leaders from Hamas were able to learn from Hezbollah about car bombings and suicide bombings, the main Hezbollah strategy and tactics. During this time, Hamas became the head of opposition to Oslo Accords, which gave them a clear political identity. By the mid-2000s, they were able to emerge as a competitor to Fatah. Hamas was not officially in politics until Arafat died in 2004. In 2006, they were democratically elected. There were ensuing clashes with Fatah, but in 2007, they took over the Gaza Strip. Although nothing is ever black and white, it is believed that the election of Hamas was more a rejection of the corrupt Palestinian Authority under Fatah. Two additional things were, Fatah hadn't delivered anything after many years of negotiations with Israel. And in 2005, Israel withdrew from Gaza. And according to one poll, 84% of Palestinians thought Hamas was responsible for this. Also of note is that in 2017, they created a revised charter. Some key elements included that Hamas believes that no part of the land of Palestine shall be compromised or conceded, irrespective of the cause, the circumstances, and the pressure, and no matter how long the occupation lasts. Hamas rejects any alternative to the full and complete liberation of Palestine from the river to the sea. However, without compromising its rejection of the Zionist entity and without relinquishing any Palestinian rights, Hamas considers the establishment of a fully sovereign and independent Palestinian state with Jerusalem as its capital along the lines of the 4th of June 1967 with the return of the refugees and the displaced to their homes from which they were expelled to be a formula of national consensus. This is a little cryptic, but perhaps it is a small shift.
This is definitely on the record.
On the record. So we are here today with Dr. Emmanuel Navon, who is an international relations expert who teaches at Tel Aviv University and at the Herzliya Interdisciplinary Center. He is a senior fellow at the Kohelet Policy Forum and a senior analyst for I-24 News, a fellow at the Jerusalem Institute for Strategic Studies, and he has recently finished a book, The Star and the Scepter, A Diplomatic History of Israel, which is awaiting publication. So today we're here to talk about kind of the current situation in Gaza and then the future. So I guess it's important to give a little bit of quick history about what the Palestinians mean when they talk about the right of return to Israel. So they mean that the Palestinians and their descendants be allowed to return to the homes that they lived in before the 1948 War of Independence, as it's referred to by Israelis, and the Nakba Day, as it's referred to by Palestinians. While it may sound simple and just, it is far more complicated, and I will get into the details which are important in a later episode. Most of the demonstrators demonstrated peacefully, but groups consisting mainly of young men did approach the border, rolled burning tires toward the fence, used burning tires to provide smoke screens, and threw stones and Molotov cocktails at Israeli troops. In April, Palestinian protesters began to launch kites bearing incendiary devices over the border fence, causing damage to property on the Israeli side and causing fires. Hamas has acknowledged deliberately using civilians at the protests as cover for their military operations. In one interview, the Hamas co-founder, Mahmoud al-Zahar, said, quote, "When we talk about peaceful resistance, we are deceiving the public," end quote. So I think as a quick side note, it's kind of shocking to me that with statements like these, where Hamas is literally saying what they are doing, many people choose to not only ignore it, but to give Hamas better motives and tactics that are more suitable and in line with their beliefs. I'm not arguing that Gazans don't have reasons to protest and that Gazans aren't clearly the inferior power, but let's call a spade a spade. Even if there were mostly peaceful protests, if some people participate in acts of violence, you can't call it a peaceful protest anymore. That being said, no one likes to hear about rising death tolls, and at least 110 Palestinians were killed between March 30th and May 15th, a number of whom were members of various Palestinian militant organizations, and a number of whom were engaged in violent acts. As Israeli soldiers fired tear gas and live ammunition, almost 14,000 Palestinians were wounded, and the death toll was highest on May 14th when 61 Palestinians were killed in the riots and various clash points along the border fence. Israel's use of force has been condemned by many human rights organizations such as Human Rights Watch, B'Tselem, Amnesty International, and it was, of course, as always, criticized by United Nations officials. So my question is this from the outsider. Is live fire needed in these situations? Would rubber bullets suffice in these kinds of situations where you have people approaching the fence or the threat of people approaching the fence?
Look, this is not a demonstration on the streets of Paris or London. You quoted yourself, a Hamas leader who said, "This is not a peaceful demonstration. We're using civilians as human shield." He said it. Now, as you mentioned, by the way, it's pretty amazing that even though he said it openly, he admitted it, many people in the West continue to deny it and say, no, then, you know, basically implying that he doesn't know what he's saying or he doesn't mean what he's saying. It's pretty amazing. He said it, for goodness sake. When you have, and there are pictures of this happening, Hamas terrorist cutting through the fence and walking through the fence, entering Israeli sovereign territory with weapons, with the declared aim of killing civilians, you don't stop this with tear gas and rubber bullets. this is an act of war. And so, yes, the use of fire is completely justified, and it's justified even by international law. It's not only justified for military reason, because there's no other way to handle that threat, but it's also recognized as such by international law. It is an act of aggression, and Israel is acting in self-defense. Now, there might have been, and there probably have been, some mistakes here and there, where Israel maybe could have, some soldiers here and there could have or should have been more careful. That might be. It's a perfectly legitimate claim. But from there to say, you're not allowed to use force, when it's not true. Any country would do the same. If you get invaded by enemies whose declared aim is to kill you civilians, you protect yourself. I mean, I can talk from personal experience. I have a son who from the past year was in a pre-IDF academy on a kibbutz, a few hundred meters from the fence. Imagine if, God forbid, those Hamas terrorists had been able not only to cross through, as many of them did, but to walk into those kibbutzim and kill people. So yes, the use of force was legitimate. And again, when there has been abuse or mistakes, this has to be looked into. And Israel is a democracy with an independent judicial system. So fine, you know, you look into it when there are mistakes. But the bottom line is that Israel was justified to use force and acted according to international law.
Okay. Do you think, given the power imbalance, that the use of force at times is disproportionate? Or you think, given the risk of, as you were saying, them crossing into Israeli territory, justifies the proportionality?
So the question here, of course, is what is proportionality? Let's say, Hamas, when they fire, let's say, 12 missiles at Israel, and one falls into a kindergarten. So is the proportional answer to fire back 12 missiles and direct them at civilians? When they fly kites with bombs that, you know, burn our fields, is the proportional answer to also fly kites towards Gaza to burn their fields? Obviously not. As I said, I spoke before about international law. Israel is entitled to use force to stop that. The question is, what is proportional? Just because you happen to be stronger in terms of your army doesn't mean that you're not allowed to defend yourself. Because if such was the case, being stronger just means you should allow yourself to be attacked. That doesn't make sense. If somebody breaks into your house, just because he's poor and doesn't have a shelter, doesn't mean you're not allowed to prevent him from entering your house. Being stronger or wealthier doesn't mean that you're not allowed to protect yourself. And so there's no disproportion in using self-defense when you shoot at people who are about to break into your fence to commit terrorist attacks on your territory. There's nothing disproportionate when you use your air force to bomb, weapon shelters within the Gaza Strip. By the way, there have been dozens of sorties of the Israeli Air Force into Gaza with very little casualties. So it's very precise. I can think of any NATO member that acted with such precision in Afghanistan or in Iraq. And I don't want to be compared to Russia. I don't want to be compared to Syria. I want to be compared to NATO members. That's fine. So it's fine if we're making those comparisons. I don't see any comparable level of precision by NATO forces in Afghanistan and in Iraq. So just because you have the most sophisticated fighting jets and just the other side doesn't mean you're not allowed to use them. And you use them to pinpointedly destroy military installations that threaten you. That's perfectly legitimate. And so this whole argument say, well, that's not fair because, you know, you have those fancy airplanes and they don't. So what, we should let them, fire us? No.
So getting into the current conditions, kind of talking about the future, taking a step away from the violence, I don't think many people would live in Gaza if given the choice. There's 45% unemployment rate, 4 hours electricity a day, wars every few years, knock on wood, not another one soon, shortages of food and many resources. Very difficult to get in and out as the Israeli and Egyptian sides have closed the borders, and Gazans can't travel abroad unless they commit to not returning for a year. Now, of course, further easing restrictions would increase quality of life for the Gazans, but as you were saying before, in this region, it always has to be balanced with security. I think it's also, before I get into any questions, I think it's also important to know that Israel, with its harsh restrictions, certainly is the main actor, but like you were saying before, it isn't the only actor. Hamas chooses to spend money building tunnels into Israel and attacking Israel rather than taking care of its own people in Gaza. And the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank they'd also like to see Hamas fall, as well, and they also impose sanctions on Hamas, which further hurts the economy in Gaza. They cut wages to the Palestinian Authority employees in Gaza, and they even requested that Israel decrease the amount of electricity supplied to Gaza. A good amount of the electricity to Gazans is supplied by Israel, and that electricity is paid for by the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank. So my question is, do you think Israel should do anything differently? Or I guess perhaps more importantly, do you think they can do anything differently while maintaining security? And when I say do anything differently, I mean let in more humanitarian goods to try and improve the lives for the Gazans.
First of all, we are in a paradox because, as I said, even though Israel did pull out in 2005, it still provides the bulk of the electricity, water, and humanitarian goods that enter the Gaza Strip, and so it's hard to claim that you completely disengage from Gaza, which was the word used by Israel in 2005. In Hebrew, the word is even stronger, itnatkut, which means to completely cut yourself. If you provide, you know, the bulk of the electricity, the water, and the goods, you didn't cut off yourself from the territory, right? Hence the claim against Israel that said, well, you're still in charge. So we provide the electricity and the water, most of it. And because of that, we're accused of still occupying Gaza. Because if we didn't provide any of those goods, people, I guess, would say, well, you have nothing to do with them. But not only do we provide those goods, but because of that, we're accused of still being in control and even being occupiers, which is the formula used by the UN, even though Israel completely pulled out in 2005 militarily. So as we mentioned before, it's a catch-22 situation because you do want to improve the humanitarian situation, but on the other hand, you don't want to help Hamas that uses any of the money that it gets in order to dig tunnels and build military equipment directed at Israel. So how do you get out of this dead end or catch-22 situation? I think a few steps have to be taken, and some of them have been suggested, of course, not only by me, by the IDF. But I do think that at the end of the day, you have to look at the wider perspective also. I do not see any scenario, any realistic scenario, of course, where the border between Gaza and Israel can be opened. It cannot. That's first of all. And I don't see a scenario either where the Gaza Strip and the West Bank can be connected in one way or the other. Part of the peace plan proposed by Ehud Olmert in 2008 included a physical connection between the West Bank and the Gaza Strip via a tunnel. But that's all we need now. We have another tunnel, you know, dug underneath Israel to join the West Bank and controlled by Hamas. So it never in the past have the Gaza Strip and the West Bank constituted one political unit. The West Bank used to be controlled by Jordan and the Gaza Strip by Egypt. So I think that even though the Palestinians, of course, claim that in a future Palestinian state it should be one political entity, I don't think it should happen, and I don't see it happening. You mentioned before that Mahmoud Abbas is cutting salaries to PA employees in Gaza, that he's asking Israel to cut the delivery of electricity. That's completely cynical. It's a game power between the PLO and Hamas. And not only, as I said before, was there a precedent where you had the West Bank and the Gaza Strip being one political unit, but if you look at another example of a partition between two populations, also within a former British-controlled territory in India. So between India and Pakistan, it used to be Pakistan was one political unit with Western Pakistan and Eastern Pakistan.
And eventually split into two political entities. 1971 was Bangladesh and Pakistan. And this has to be more or less the model. You don't want to have one political unit. And so eventually, the Gaza Strip, where should it open up? Open up, not towards the West Bank, not towards Israel, but more towards Egypt and Sinai. Now, of course, I'm aware of the fact that the Egyptians are not interested in that. And it's all a matter of what do they get in return. But the same way that they did control the Gaza Strip between 1949 and 1967, I think that the opening to the world and the lessening of the misery of the Gaza Strip has to come through an opening towards Sinai and towards Egypt. That should be the direction. And since the Egyptian government today of al-Sisi is so dependent economically on the United States and the Gulf states, when President Trump asked the Gulf states and Saudi Arabia to invest in Gaza, there's a reason why the PA was so much against it, because they see it as a first step to really detach the Gaza Strip from the PA-controlled polity and as an opening towards Egypt. And that should be the direction. Now, you can also have there a few ideas, for example, of having an internationally monitored port for the Gaza Strip, whether in Cyprus or somewhere else, because yes, you have to enable, at the end of the day, Gaza to be more open to the world without letting Hamas import weapons. So that should be, in my opinion, the direction. An internationally monitored port to enable Gaza to trade with the rest of the world without letting Hamas import weapons. And the opening, the economic opening, should be towards Egypt. But there should be, of course, an incentive offered to al-Sisi. I mean, a couple of years ago, he sold an island to Saudi Arabia. So it's probably also a question of price, you know. How much would it cost to sell Gaza to Egypt, if you want, putting it almost cynically? But that's really what it is.
I think that's an interesting point. I think, you know, for the longest time, obviously, most of the international community has stuck by this two-state solution with these strict guidelines of the West Bank and Gaza being, you know, one entity, a future Palestinian state, and all these things. And I think it's interesting to kind of take a step back. And as I mentioned briefly in the history of Gaza, the mandate of Palestine under the British, I mean, that was the first time that those exact borders existed. And prior to that, during the Ottoman Empire, what is now Gaza, I believe, would have been separate from what a lot of the West Bank is. They were separate sanjaks. So, I mean, while they definitely share, you know, this gets into a deeper question of, you know, what makes a nation, what provides, you know, the unification of a nationality, but certainly they both were affected by Zionism, and they both were affected by the creation of Israel, which definitely brings them together. But prior to that, perhaps they were separate entities. So I guess I'd also like to ask about kind of Israel's game plan. Sometimes it seems a little bit as if, you know, they don't really have much of a game plan in Gaza. Sometimes people will also say, you know, they don't have much of a game plan in the West Bank, you know, with continued settlement buildings. Are they committed to two states or not? But it's very tricky to see kind of what Israel's plan is in Gaza, because it sounds like they could ease a little bit of the humanitarian crisis. They're in control so much. Obviously, it's very complicated, as you were saying. You don't want to prop up Hamas. But I mean, I think this was Israel's initial plan, was to kind of make life in Gaza so miserable that they turned against Hamas. But, you know, in addition to, you know, obviously it's not fair to kind of put, you know, kind of use the Gazans as pawns, but publicly opposing Hamas is not an easy task. As Amnesty International states, the Palestinian authorities in the West Bank and the Hamas de facto administration in the Gaza Strip escalated their restrictions on freedom of expression. In both areas, security forces tortured and otherwise ill-treated detainees with impunity. The authorities in the West Bank took punitive actions against the Hamas administration that further restricted the civilian population's access to vital services, exacerbating the humanitarian crisis resulting from Israel's military blockade of Gaza. I remember during the 2014 war, a BBC reporter recounted a boy who was dragged from his bed in the middle of the night and had his kneecap shot off for writing an anti-Hamas Facebook post. Hamas is known to execute suspected collaborators without due process, and according to the NGO Palestinian Center for Development and Media Freedoms, in January, security forces in Gaza violently dispersed a protest in Jabalia refugee camp, which was protesting against Hamas's mismanagement of the electricity crisis. Activists and organizers were detained, threatened, and in some cases tortured for organizing the demonstrations. One activist, Muhammad al-Taloli, was arrested on three occasions throughout the year for his role in organizing the protests and also received death threats. So it's kind of tough. I mean, I'd ask, what is Hamas's approval rating? Could this even be accurately assessed due to the repression of free speech throughout the strip?
As you mentioned, when you're when Hamas pulls out a child out of its bed and shoots it in his knees because he posted something on Facebook against Hamas, it's obviously hard to get an accurate picture of public opinion. Because even though, yes, in 2006, technically Hamas won the legislative election to the Palestinian Authority, there haven't been elections since then. And Gazans haven't been asked and haven't been given the opportunity to express themselves again since then. And that was over 12 years ago. So we don't know. Hamas is holding on power by force without the approval of the population or recent approval of the population. So we don't know, but I cannot imagine anybody who would approve of being so repressed and mistreated. You know, having the Gaza Strip, if the Gaza Strip is such a misery, it's mostly because Hamas is responsible for the three or four wars that were it initiated against Israel since 2007, and using its resources for building tunnels and personal corruption of its leaders and firing rockets at Israel. So I can't imagine anybody who would approve of that.
But do you think the Gazans, they see this as Hamas's fault? Or do you think they see this as Israel's fault and Hamas is just kind of their only hope to kind of fight against?
Look, I have no doubt that Hamas blames Israel for anything. Like, blaming Israel is always easier. And I'm sure that this is what they're doing all the time. But again, it is Hamas that is building tunnels that cost a lot of money. It uses a lot of resources.
Mm-hmm.
Building those tunnels under Israel uses up a lot of resources and money. Buying missiles and operating them also costs a lot of money. You don't see this money invested in infrastructure. You don't see it being invested in school, hospitals, roads. Recently, when President Trump asked the Gulf states and Saudi Arabia to invest in the Gaza Strip, both Hamas and the PLO said, no, don't do that. Because they don't want this money to get out of their control. So it goes to show that they care more about the political control than the welfare of the population. The last war with Israel was 4 years ago. The infrastructure in Gaza has not really been rebuilt. There's no water sewage. Why? I mean, why don't they build a water sewage? They have all this money from the Gulf states, from Iran. They use that money for military purposes. It's not Israel's job to rebuild the sewage in Gaza. Israel is no longer an Israeli military government in the Gaza Strip. It's not Israel's responsibility. So, of course, blaming Israel is a national sport in the Arab world. Israel is not running the Gaza Strip despite the restrictions that we mentioned before, and it's not Israel's responsibility to rebuild the infrastructure there.
Is it possible to fully rebuild the infrastructure given the restrictions on goods?
Look, they had no problem building thousands of tunnels. So if you're able to build all the sophisticated tunnels deep underground, obviously you have enough material and expertise to build pipes, water pipes, you know.
Okay. So I think based on this discussion, we're able to see that, you know, this is pretty much turned into a catch-22 for Israel. It's basically a complete quagmire and it's a very difficult situation. And I think a lot of Israelis kind of see this or saw Gaza as kind of an experiment, and certainly a failed experiment, in that they pulled out and they gave Palestinians control only to get Hamas elected and rockets fired at them. Now, obviously, we discussed how that control has changed, you know, as a result of Hamas being elected, but it's an absolute disaster for the Palestinians in quality of life and for the Israelis, in that every conflict in Gaza leads to international uproar and condemnation. So I think this outcome has shaped the opinion of mainstream Israelis, in that if you ask about pulling out of the West Bank, the most common response will be like, why? So it can turn into Gaza, except this time there'll be rockets in reach of major metropolitan centers. So do you think pulling out of Gaza was a mistake?
Yes, even if the rationale, even if there was a rationale to it. But I think Sharon's objective when he pulled out of Gaza, without getting into his other motivations related at the time to, you know, police investigations against him. But even without getting into speculation about what were his other motivations with regard to his legal troubles. I do think that at the end of the day, he wanted to redraw Israel's borders in order to preserve the Jewish majority of Israel. And since there was obviously no prospect of reaching an agreement with the Palestinians in light of the failed Camp David summit and the Clinton proposals rejected by Arafat and then the Second Intifada, the conclusion reached by Sharon and many at the time was like, on the one hand, you're not going to have a negotiated agreement which is unreachable. On the other hand, maintaining the status quo would be demographically suicidal for Israel. And therefore, if until now the paradigm was territory for peace, from now on it would be neither territory nor peace. In order, we will give away territory not to achieve a peace that is unachievable, but only in order to preserve our Jewish majority. So there was definitely a rationale behind this move. I'm not saying it was absurd. There was a logic to it.
Mm-hmm.
But the outcome, it was brilliant in theory and a disaster in practice. The outcome was disastrous. Objectively today, the situation was better for Israel and for the Palestinians when the Gaza Strip was controlled by Israel. Objectively. So I'm not saying it was an ideal situation, not at all. But if you compare both the life of the Palestinians in Gaza today and of the Israelis surrounding the Gaza Strip today, it was much better 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
It's obvious. And I'm not only talking about the complete destruction of life in Gaza, I'm also talking about the fact that Israelis living around the Gaza border live into this permanent threat, and one day it's tunnels, the other day it's missiles, and after that it's burning kites. So on the one hand, you had a certain logic to the unilateral strategy / disengagement, but on the other hand, in the long term, it has turned into a complete disaster for both sides. So if you would repeat this to the West Bank or most of it, which is what Sharon intended to do originally, and Olmert also, before he started the Annapolis process negotiations, etc., etc., you know, basic logic says that you would have the same scenario. I don't see any reason why it would be any different. In fact, it would be worse because the territory is about 20 times larger. The topography is such that you have those mountains in the West Bank overlooking Israel's coastal plain. We have 80% of the population living. Ben Gurion International Airport, Jerusalem. It would be a mega disaster. Which is why, again, Israel is in a bind. It's a catch-22 situation. You maintain the status quo, you have the demographic threat. You want to reach an agreement, forget about it. They keep talking about the right of return, etc., etc. You pull unilaterally, you make the situation worse. So it is a catch-22. But on the other hand, it doesn't prevent this lack of solution in the foreseeable future. It does not prevent Israel from being a huge success story. So it's unfortunate, but it's not a disaster for Israel, this lack of solution, because Israel is a success story and continues to flourish. And its international standing has never been better. So, as I said, it's unfortunate, but it's not disastrous.
So, given the situation that Israel's in today, given the situation of Gaza, given Hamas is still in power and Trump's pending peace plan, do you think that, I'm hesitant to say peaceful negotiation, you know, given our discussion here, but do you think a negotiation or a lasting peace in any way can be achieved while Hamas is in power in Gaza?
Why Hamas? What about the PLO? What about Abbas? 83-year-old Abbas, who was last elected in 2005 and has rejected the peace offer by Ehud Olmert in 2008 and the John Kerry / Obama offer in February 2014. So why would he accept a much less generous offer from his point of view when he wants his legacy to be at least somebody who didn't sell out the Palestinians to American and Israeli pressures? Why should he go down in history as somebody who said no to Olmert and no to Obama, but would say yes to Trump on a proposal that would be about half of what Obama offered him? There's no way. So the problem here is not only Hamas. It is also, and I would say mostly, Abbas.
Interesting. But if, let's say hypothetically, let's enter a dream world right now, Abbas gives in to the negotiating ability of Trump and agrees, do you think that some sort of agreement can be achieved with Hamas in power? And the reason, you know, I keep bringing this up with Hamas in power is because they talk about in their revised charter of 2017, they said, you know, maybe they'll recognize two states, but they're not giving up the right of the future generations to take up resistance. You know, they frequently talk about Israel being such a holy place, Jerusalem, because of its holiness, being so holy that no one can negotiate or, you know, give it up. But do you think, you know, given this, that Israel would agree to this? Because I think that there's, you know, a big difference. I think the most important difference is we will never cease wanting versus we will never cease fighting for. The great majority of Israelis would say, we'll never, you know, sure, would we want the West Bank? Absolutely. Like, and I don't think they'll ever not want that, but the difference is they won't be fighting for it. So I think given Hamas's revised charter, they'll say, you know, it still says essentially that they're never going to stop fighting for that. So do you think that Israel could ever accept that?
We had exactly the same discussion and problem with the PLO 30 years ago. Not only because of the PLO charter, but also because of the PLO's decision in Cairo in 1974. This decision called the Stages Approach, the Plan of Stages, that also said, we're not going to give up the dream, but in the meantime, we're willing to compromise in order to implement the dream. That was the PLO phased plan, 1974. So Israelis were saying that, what's the point? They themselves say that the only reason for them to be willing to compromise temporarily is only to continue the liberation of Palestine. So they're not even trying to fool us. So what we're discussing now about Hamas was the same thing about the PLO. Now, when the PLO signed the 20 years later, the Oslo agreements, Arafat made it clear. You know, he spoke in Johannesburg after signing the second Oslo agreement in 1994. And he said, yes, it's we just implemented the phase plan that we adopted 20 years ago. And he did. So, you know, and he never abandoned the fights. And so when he saw that he was not going to achieve everything he wanted to achieve at Camp David, he started using war again, thinking that, he said, the fight is not over. So there's no difference, really. I mean, true Abbas is less, you know, he doesn't dress like Arafat, he doesn't talk like Arafat. But, you know, the bottom line of the PLO, you know, when people try to make this kind of dichotomy between Hamas, which is religious and radical and is only willing maybe to compromise to fool the enemy, that's also the PLO. And unfortunately, when Arafat signed Camp David, it was not a strategic decision. It was just in order to save himself from oblivion, because he was dead politically. PLO was bankrupt, and Israel offered him this Faustian deal when he would save himself by signing those agreements, which left everything open, basically. He signed a blank check, and so when it came to tough negotiation on the core issues, he was not willing to compromise. So I don't agree with this kind of dichotomy between Hamas and the PLO. They're not that different, in my opinion.
Thank you very much for all your insights.
Thank
it's
you.
It's been an absolute pleasure, and I hope that we can have you on again soon.
Gladly.
We just heard from Professor Navon, an Israeli, about his perspectives and the real security concerns that Israel faces. Now we are going to hear from Dr. Leila Al-Mariati about the real humanitarian concerns that the Gazans experience. Today, I have this pleasure of speaking with Dr. Leila Al-Mariati, an OBGYN and clinical professor of medicine at the Keck School of Medicine at USC, the former presidential appointee to the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, and current chairperson of Kinder USA, a nonprofit which provides humanitarian assistance to Palestinian children in the West Bank, Gaza, and Lebanon. So I thought we could start with you briefly talking about your connection to Gaza. When was the last time you were there? Do you currently have family there?
Yes, I'm part of the Al-Fara family. That was my father's last name, and a very large family in Gaza, particularly in Khan Yunis, in the southern part of the Gaza Strip. They have been there for centuries, so we are not part of the refugee community, if you will, but really of the families that were already living in Gaza at the time in 1948 and beyond. So I have a lot of relatives, aunts, uncles, cousins. The last time I was there was in 2013, and it's really quite difficult for me to go. I have been prevented from entering Israel for I don't know what reason on a couple of occasions, and therefore the only way I can go to Gaza is through Egypt and to travel across the Sinai, which has become more and more dangerous over the last few years. And the fact border is closed, so you never know if the Egyptian side will be open even if you do go there. So it's really been difficult. One of my aunts lives here in California. Her daughter and grandchildren are there in Gaza. She Skypes with them every single day in order to have a relationship with them. But she has not been able to go back for probably 8 or 9 years now. I don't know if she ever will.
Okay. In addition to getting in and out, what are some of the other difficulties in the daily life of your relatives there that you've been able to kind of hear about?
Well, I think it's mostly the problem with lack of electricity is a big one. Some of our relatives, our family has have generators. If there's fuel for the generator, then you can continue to have electricity. But it's disruptive. And just, you know, in these young women, for example, these young cousins of mine who are going through junior high, high school, getting ready to go to college and looking at what kind of opportunities there are for them in terms of work afterwards, even in terms of marriage, you know, if people don't have the funds to be able to afford to get married, it's just this very kind of contracted life because it's confined to this space that no matter what, you can't get out of. And I think that has a psychological effect on people. Even if they chose never to travel, the fact that they can't pursue, you know, higher education elsewhere like Gazans used to do. They used to go to the West Bank or outside of the country altogether. Job opportunities, the unemployment rate is very high. So all of that takes its toll. But in the meantime, at the same time, people carry on with their daily lives. They have their children. They go to school. They try to find some pleasure in life, whether it's going to the beach or sitting with friends, doing things like everyone everywhere else does. So they try to make the best of it. And as you're probably aware, there are a lot of religious people very devoted to their faith, and I think that helps people get through sometimes as well. But there's every single aspect of life is impacted. So if you need medical care and they don't have the equipment, the supplies, and so forth, it's just if you think of your own daily life and imagining one obstacle after another in order to get things done that we just would take for granted.
Mm-hmm. And when you talk about the difficulties getting in and out, you were talking about how people used to go to study in the West Bank and other places. Is that specifically after 2005 or after 2006 and 2007, once Hamas took over and Israel imposed a blockade?
Yeah, once the blockade was in place, everything stopped. And even before that, I have relatives that really before the second intifada started in 2002, not so much about Hamas taking over, but about the thing sort of exploding, if you will, throughout the region. Relatives would go and work in Israel. They learned Hebrew, even from Gaza. That was a commonplace thing for people to do. And as you know, that was sort of the workforce in Israel itself. And then after the intifada started in 2002, the barrier started going up, blockade in Gaza, and so on and so forth, and that all changed. And so now there's this idea of separation and confinement. And in Gaza, it's much easier to isolate that population because Israel controls all of the borders, other than the one with Egypt, which doesn't really impact Israel. And now that Egypt is effectively doing the same thing, that's a way to control that Palestinian population. Mm-hmm. Whether or not, to me, it didn't matter if it's whoever's in charge. You know, I mean, if there's aspects of one political group versus another, if there's any kind of activity that's considered, you know, violent or military against Israel, it doesn't really matter who's in charge, because then they would be held accountable for whatever is going on. So whether any political leader could control that or not is almost irrelevant in my mind. It's Israel's looking at its security 100%, and therefore, you know, to control these borders and to limit any exposure is possible when it's Gaza compared to the West Bank.
So when you talk about the current humanitarian situation, you kind of mentioned that Israel does most of this for security purposes. Do you put the responsibility completely on Israel for the current humanitarian situation? Are other political entities that also can receive and share some of the blame, or do you put it mainly on Israel?
Well, I think from my perspective as a Palestinian American looking at this, having been there, I mean, Israel always has the upper hand, always. I mean, they're always in charge. You know, they have all of the cards. So at the same time, on the day-to-day functioning of life in, say, Gaza, and in 2005, why did they vote one party into power as opposed to another? It's because of corruption, because even just their daily lives were being affected. There was insecurity in the streets. People were getting, you know, carjackings were taking place. So the people chose who they thought might help provide daily security, and just in their immediate daily life. They're not looking at the bigger political picture. They're not thinking about what impact this has on negotiations and so forth. They're like, how's my life going to be better today? Am I going to feel safe in terms of sending my children off to school? So that had huge repercussions, though, because of the relationships and, you know, the past history. So then that created this blockade or siege, because Israel is not going to have any relationship with what they call a terrorist entity. But on the ground, on day-to-day living, of course, whoever's got that political authority, the people also look to for accountability. But for the overall picture of the blockade, it's up to Israel. Like, they can decide. And I've never read or seen anything that says, if you do X, Y, and Z, we'll lift the blockade. If you've seen it, you could share that. But I've never seen that. And so Israel, to me, is really in control. And then as far as the southern border in Rafah, that obviously is under the control of Egypt. And that's what has changed in terms of access for people who couldn't, you know, have access outside through the borders of Israel. At least they could go to and from Egypt, but now that's been curtailed significantly as well.
Yeah, I know that for some of the things getting in and out, Israel prevents it because they perceive that it's going to be used to build for tunnels or weaponry to then be used against Israel. But I know that there are a lot of humanitarian goods that people kind of look at and don't really see why that can't get in. But onto kind of a little bit more of a controversial question. How do you think Israel should respond to the rocket fire?
I think Israel, as the country with the upper hand, should take the lead on getting us out of this mess that we're in, you know, and starting to push negotiations to settle this, and to not, you know, consistently punish and collectively punish a majority unarmed population with disproportionate use of force. It's not just about that. It's that this is a symptom of a larger problem that needs to be addressed by the stakeholders and by others in the world who can help bring them to the table. That's what you have to do. You negotiate with your enemies, not with your friends. You know, and the United States led that process in Northern Ireland when negotiations with the Irish Republican Army, which did not disarm at the time in order for negotiations to take place, and the settlement was created. So, you know, there should be a proportionate response if there's going to be one, but the kind of attack you saw in 2014 was really unfathomable, you know, in terms of looking at the kind of devastation and destruction that was meted out against Gaza. So I'm not sure what purpose that serves, what it accomplishes. Of course, people come to different conclusions. From there, we, you know, what is the threat that we as the small little enclave of mostly unarmed people really pose? And why does so much effort have to be placed in bringing, you know, the maximum military force against them? F-16s, Apache helicopter gunships. When I was there in 2009, drones were flying overhead all the time. You know, you hear a helicopter here. I hear a helicopter in my area, and I'm relieved because it could be a sign that there's security, or when we had recent fires. But a helicopter in Gaza, because the only people flying helicopters are Israeli military, people are immediately instilled with fear because it's usually a helicopter gunship. It's just, and when you're there on the ground with kids running around, people, families, and you're looking at even just the level of proportionality, it's hard for me to comprehend. So yeah. I don't really know if I have a good answer to your question, but I think it's a symptom of a larger problem that certainly the parties have the ability to, if they have the will, to bring to an end.
Yeah, no, I think we can most definitely agree that the people in Gaza not only need a better life, but deserve it as well. So I guess in terms of negotiating to allow them to have a better future, do you think any sort of peace deal or any sort of negotiation to allow for an improvement of life for Gazans can be achieved while Hamas is in power?
As I said, we've the United States has participated in discussions with other groups that were similarly labeled. So I don't see why that is an impossible barrier. I mean, we talk about like one's right to exist, the others, Palestinians, you know, the feeling is, and when you're on the ground in Gaza, you're like, oh, we're being completely destroyed here. Mm-hmm. You're not talking about equal partners, and any negotiations can be complex, but I think that if you have the will to make things better because it matters, you can find a way to get it through. And in the past, you know, Hamas and Israel have negotiated ceasefires over the years. That's something they've been doing for over a decade. So they are talking to each other. There is some kind of, you know, contact. Everybody's aware of that. It would be naive to assume that it doesn't happen, or even if it's through third parties, to come to some kind of resolution. Because what we're looking at also is really sort of the economic ability for people to thrive. Palestinians are very resourceful in the northern part of the Gaza Strip before this whole area was completely destroyed, actually in, I think, 2009, and then really wiped out in 2014, was that industrial area where people had factories or farms, and then you could get produce and other commodities to and from the West Bank or from Israel. The Gazans still receive products from Israel. You look at the markets in Gaza, they're all filled with Israeli products. So they are a consumer of Israeli products, and there could be this economic relationship that could be mutually beneficial to everyone. There's different ways you can look at it. That's not my background in terms of how do you manage, like, you know, these advanced high-level negotiations. But I have to believe as a human being that we're capable of doing that. And again, it's looking at who are the stakeholders. That's why bringing in other parties that also can help advocate for the best interests of everyone would be important, especially, you know, to give these people a chance. But what we're looking for is economic growth and development, opportunities for education, freedom to move, freedom to, you know, marry and to relocate, all those things that we look at as just a normal part of our lives. I think that regardless of who's in charge here and there, you know, you have to deal with the person across this table, whether it's in Israel, Palestine, whether it's in Afghanistan, whatever part of the world, because the people of those countries really deserve that.
All right. And then to finish up, I just wanted to get your take on the recent March of Return and the protests, what your thoughts were on the Israeli response to the threat of the border breaches.
Tell me what you mean by the Israeli response.
The use of live fire. I mean, it seems that there's often high death tolls whenever there seems to be any kind of clashes. On the one hand, Israel claims that they need to defend their borders, which they have a legal right to as other countries. On the other hand, people will claim that they once again use disproportionate force with use of live fire and that the casualties just mount up way too quickly.
It's a little bit disingenuous to talk about it as like, oh, we have to defend ourselves against another country like anybody else would.
Mm.
Gaza doesn't have sovereignty. Gaza doesn't have, I mean, what do they have? If you've ever been there, if you see what that is, this March of Return was the reaction to what happened with possibly moving the embassy to Jerusalem, but also to the sense of like desperation. I mean, the siege has been gone. It's a decade. That things are getting really bad. What do they have to lose? Nothing. And it's not a border breach. I mean, these are just human beings that have no other option. They want to get out. Like, it's, think of it as people who have been confined in prison, and they're not criminals. You know, and Israel has dealt with demonstrations, Jewish demonstrators in Israel. They don't use live ammunition against them. And these people are unarmed, and I know they have those incendiary devices and what have you, but it's like a kite, a balloon, seriously? So it's really, again, it's a symptom of a larger problem. It's not about a border breach like you would with another country. This is a territory that you actually control and are contributing to this desperation and on the other side. That people, that this would be a realistic option for people, that they think that that's somehow going to be successful for them. What's got to be going on in their minds that they would think that this is what I'm going to do? I'm going to go and storm this fence and risk getting shot to death. What am I going to do? Run all the way to Jerusalem and defend it there? You have to think about where the mindset is coming from when you read interviews of people who are there at these marches. It's that we have nothing left to lose, and we want to stand with dignity for something that we care about. So whether it's manipulated by the authorities or what have you and how they do it, you know, there's still this very organic kind of grassroots desire to want to be free, regardless of how it's exploited by the leadership. And I think that's what this is a reflection of. So to respond to that with live fire, you may have seen some of the YouTube videos also of some celebrations of, you know, of shooting some of these victims. It's also part of the idea of looking at Gazans as less than human, right? So we can treat them that way. And if you're looking at them through the scope of a rifle and you're not really having to interact with them as human beings, it contributes to that desensitization and dehumanization that makes it possible to treat them this way and sort of not to look at this from their perspective and the situation that they're in, but rather from a sort of a defensive posture.
Do you think that those trying to breach the fence didn't intend to harm any of the local population?
What were they going to do if they got through?
There were some reports that they were carrying weapons and planned to attack local communities.
I mean, I don't know. I didn't read that. I'm not aware of that. And so, of course, in the moment, you know, they have to do what they have to do to defend the communities. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's going to keep happening because this is a reflection of this anguish and frustration and desperation.
Yeah.
So doing what you have to do to protect your communities, that's what you have to do. And I would say historically, the history just shows everyone. It's not a debate about the disproportionality of the force. It's not a debate when, you know, you have Israel has one of the largest militaries of the region of the world. It's just so blatant. It's not even debatable. The disproportionality of what you have, you know, in terms of equipment and firepower, all of that. So they have that responsibility then. Yes, they could use much more excessive force, so they have to restrain it. Do you have to blow up whole buildings? I think that, again, the justification for that relates, again, to the overall lack of interest in pushing anything forward in terms of a negotiated agreement, as well as dehumanization of the Palestinian people in general and Gazans specifically. I do think that is a huge factor. But on the ground, you do what you have to do to defend your population. Nobody would argue with that. If people breach the fence and you have to deal with something, but why is that fence there? What does this mean? What does this border mean? What really is going on here? What is this a reflection of? And do all those Palestinians deserve to be treated that way? It's the most densely populated place on earth, so it's not an easy answer.
Often very complicated. Okay, any other last words or comments?
You know, I appreciate the opportunity to participate, to talk. There's a lot of hostility that's out there just, you know, in terms of representing our point of view. So I really appreciate having that chance. At the same time, I think that it really is important for us to approach this from that perspective of trying to alleviate suffering that has been going on much too long. And so it's kind of an appeal to everyone, to the listeners, that this is about people who are being treated in a way that they don't deserve, and but they deserve the same rights as everyone else, these children in Gaza and elsewhere. So if we can start to think of them, maybe that will help move us past this impasse that we're at right now.
Thank you so very much for participating. Very much appreciated, and we hope to have you on again soon.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you to all the participants. A big thank you to Michael Secular for all the sound editing, and we will see you all next time.
The podcast you just heard was made using Anchor. Ever thought about making your own podcast? Anchor makes it really easy for anyone to get started. It's a one-stop shop for recording, hosting, and distributing podcasts. Best of all, it's 100% free. Sign up now at anchor.fm/new. That's anchor.fm/new to get started.